Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello from Washington. We are here to help you learn and improve your American English. At the same time, you will learn about interesting and important things happening all around us. Today's program is all about sound, a special kind of music from America's West Coast, and then sound or noise in our forests. You are going to like this one. So let's get started with Anna Mateo.
People are scared of you guys. You have a unique voice. The world needs to hear it.
They want N.W.A.? Let's give them N.W.A.
The music genre, known as gangster or gangsta rap, was born in the poor, dangerous neighborhood of Compton in Los Angeles, California. The violence of street life there and tense relations between the community and police influenced the sound. The music expressed the anger and distrust of the community. Movie director F. Gary Gray explores that world through the story of N.W.A., the band that revolutionized rap in the 1980s.
You have a unique voice. The world needs to hear it.
They want N.W.A.? Let's give them N.W.A.
One of the band members, O'Shea Jackson, grew up in Compton. He wrote songs on the school bus that reflected his experiences. He later took the stage name Ice Cube. Ice Cube wrote one song about the gangster who got on his school bus and put a gun to a classmate's head. He also wrote about the police who handcuffed him and threatened his parents because he happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Where do you think you're going?
Man, I'm just trying to get home.
That's my son!
You need to get back in the house or I will ruin your night.
Mr. Gray's film shows Ice Cube teaming up with his friends, Dre, an expert in music production, Eazy-E, a charismatic performer, as well as MC Run and DJ Yella. They created the rap group N.W.A. and rapped about drugs, sex, violence, and poverty.
You're listening to Compton's very own Ice Cube, Eazy-E, and Dr. Dre. I gotta tell you, you are witnessing history.
F. Gary Gray said he worked hard to keep the story as real as possible, including filming in Compton.
This is not only history, it's American history, it's world history. And so I get a chance to put on my journalist hat and be a historian.
Ice Cube is one of the film's producers. He remembers those times.
Our music was like our weapon,
and that's the most powerful weapon we got.
He said the band did not use guns to fight back. Instead, they used a microphone. In his words, at the end of the day, we're still artists. Ice Cube's son, O'Shea Jackson Jr., portrays him as a young man in the film. Thinking about his father's music, the younger Jackson said, they talked about the things others were scared to talk about and shed light on the things that people needed to know. Straight Outta Compton has received mostly positive reviews from movie critics. However, some have argued that the film fails to address reports of abusive treatment of women by N.W.A. members. But N.W.A.'s music caused severe public reaction outside of Compton. The media sharply criticized the group. The police had N.W.A.'s members under watch. The band even received a letter from the FBI. The letter asked the group to remove song lyrics that included threatening language directed at the police.
Your songs, they glamorize gangs and drugs.
Our art is a reflection of our reality.
In one scene in the film, Ice Cube speaks at a press conference about the group's constitutional right to free speech. But his words were not especially helpful to the cause. NWA members were repeatedly arrested and beaten up by police and by gangsters. The film centers on NWA's rise to fame and the relationships among its members. It suggests that money and fame damaged those friendships and led to the breakup of the group. The film's depictions of police violence are especially powerful, coming after the police killings of unarmed black men such as Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner in New York City. The film had a very successful opening weekend. It made more than $56 million in ticket sales in the United States last weekend. Industry experts are expecting the film to continue to attract big audiences this weekend. I'm Ana Mateo.
That was fun. Thanks, Anna. Now, something about noise outdoors and its effects on our animal friends. Biologists from Boise State University have been making noise in the forests of the western American state of Idaho. They are making noise to study the value of quiet in nature. They want to know how people and animals react to noise pollution. The researchers placed outdoor speakers on the side of a half-kilometer-long part of a road in the Boise National Forest. For 2 years, they played the sounds of passing cars through the speakers. Professor Jesse Barber of Boise State University says they found the sounds caused migratory birds to flee. The birds also failed to gain weight. Recently, researchers played sounds of machines that are used to remove natural gas from the ground. That sound is heard in natural gas fields throughout the American West. Professor Barber says these experiments are designed to help researchers learn the effects of noise pollution on birds, insects, bats, plants, and people.
We're testing the idea that these things are coupled, that as the soundscape gets louder, wildlife suffers, but that also feeds back onto how much people get out of that experience, how much they value it, and thus how much they're willing to protect that same place.
The research team also studied a group of volunteers who watch birds for fun. Mitch Levenhagen is a graduate student in the research team. He measured how much the artificial noise lessened the ability of the bird watchers to identify recorded bird songs. He recorded 8 songs in the noise condition and 8 songs in the quiet. He then repeated the experiment without the artificial noise. The bird watchers were happy when the noise machine was shut off.
Yay!
The bird watchers said the artificial noise affected their ability to identify bird sounds more than they thought it would. Bird watcher Jim Lyon said the experiment caused him to value quiet more.
I just think the whole thing has been ear-opening, shall we say, to be part of this. Very stimulating, very interesting, and getting to think a lot about it, I know, from now on.
Volunteer Janice Engel said she, too, likes the quiet.
I moved out of the city to, I bought a little place in the country where I wanted it to be quiet. I greatly value that. It's hard to find those places more and more. There are lots of ways to mitigate sound, but it's a trade-off. There's always a cost, and it comes down to people's values. What do we value more?
The National Park Service is paying for some noise pollution research. The federal agency is also examining other ways to reduce noise. They include putting new surfaces on roads, and they are creating quiet areas with signs telling visitors to turn off their mobile phones. Next year, Mr. Levenhagen and Professor Barber will go to Northern California to ask visitors at Muir Woods National Monument and other parks how they feel about noise. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. Ice caps, very large sheets of ice, do not only exist at the Earth's poles. There are tropical ice caps in mountain ranges, too. The largest, the Quilcaya ice cap, is on top of the Andes Mountains in Peru. But the Quilcaya ice cap is melting quickly. Experts say it might be gone in the next 20 years. Scientists are taking samples to gather valuable information about climate change stored in Quilcaya's ice. The Andes Mountains stretch across the nations of Bolivia, Ecuador, and Peru. The countries rely on large glaciers for their water supply. But a 2009 report by the World Bank warns that climate change might lead to glaciers completely disappearing. This could put water, energy, food sources, and residents in those regions at risk. Experts say that in the past 30 years, the world's tropical glaciers have lost more than 20% of their ice and snow. Lonnie Thompson is a climate scientist with Ohio State University.
The day will come when there will no longer be a Quilcaya ice cap, and the history that's preserved here will no longer be available. So in many ways, we also salvaging a history of our past that will be lost as the Earth continues to warm.
Scientists study climate change and volcanic eruptions by looking at air bubbles and dust particles trapped in the ice. Evidence shows that pollution in South America was started by humans in the 1500s. That is when explorers from Spain forced the native people to mine silver. But the highest increase in pollution and the fastest melting of ice started in the 20th century. Photographs show some glaciers have lost almost 50% of their ice and snow over the past 33 years. We can see that the glaciers have been retreating more and more with time, said researcher Roxana Sierra. This is because the temperature has been increasing. Scientists say only a few places remain on Earth today where human impact on air quality can be measured. The Quilcaya ice cap is one of those places where scientists can study how the Industrial Revolution from 1750 to 1850 changed the air we breathe. And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report. For more technology stories, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Give us a like on the VOA Learning English Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter, at VOA Learn English. You can also watch videos on the VOA Learning English YouTube channel.
I'm Jonathan Evans. From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. The United States declared war on Britain in 1812. It did so because Britain refused to stop seizing American ships that traded with France, Britain's enemy in Europe. Sometimes there were also seizures of American sailors. These seizures were known as impressment. Britain finally suspended its orders against neutral trade after a change in government. But the British acted too late. The United States had already declared war. Today, we continue the story of the War of 1812. Most of Britain's forces were battling the soldiers of Napoleon Bonaparte in Europe. Historian and Pulitzer Prize winner Alan Taylor says that as a result, the British could send only a small force to the United States.
And so the British were basically fighting the war against the United States on the defensive in Canada while trying to raid the American coast using their advantage in the more powerful Royal Navy.
For its part, the United States was far from ready to fight. The country had not fought a war or needed an army for a long time. There were only 8,000 American soldiers. The soldiers, who were young, knew little about war. And the officers who knew about war were old enough to have led troops in the American Revolution. President James Madison named two top generals, 62-year-old Henry Dearborn and 63-year-old Thomas Pinckney. The United States had only a few warships and gunboats with which to face the British Navy, the most powerful naval force in the world. Historian and professor Alan Taylor says the American people were divided about the war.
A majority of them supported the Madison administration and agreed that they tried the embargo, it failed, and that something had to be done because national honor, they felt, was at stake, and that they needed to stop the British practice of impressment. And they were also upset about the British military aid to these Indian peoples who were restricting American expansion.
Alan Taylor says, for those reasons, many Americans supported the war, particularly in the southern, western, and mid-Atlantic states.
But in New England, most of the people supported the opposition party, the Federalists, and they were very bitter about the war. They felt that it was really being waged for illegitimate reasons, that diplomacy could have just papered over the disagreement over impressment. And so they did their best to obstruct the war effort. They not only didn't want to contribute to the war effort, but they wanted to block it as best they could.
Church bells were rung and flags were lowered in New England when the declaration of war was announced. There was also the problem of getting enough men to serve as soldiers. Congress had approved an increase of 25,000 men. Only 5,000 agreed to serve. Members of Congress from the western states had spoken proudly of how their people would rush to fight the British. This did not happen. The first request to Kentucky for soldiers produced only 400 men. Historian Alan Taylor says that some states in the Northeast did not offer any soldiers at all, especially for invasions into Canada.
And even when the governors would cooperate, as did, for example, the governor of New York, the militia would often march to the border and then decide that their constitutional duty was only to defend their state. and not to help the United States invade another country. And so they'd go on a sit-down strike once they got to the border.
Nevertheless, an American general named William Hull led 2,000 men across the Canadian border. But the British general there was prepared, and the attack failed. Although Hull had the stronger force and plenty of supplies, he retreated to Detroit. He was chased by a smaller force of British soldiers and Indians. After the war, Hull was tried by a military court on charges of cowardice. The court found him guilty and ordered him shot. But President Madison, because of Hull's service during the Revolutionary War, permitted the old soldier to live. The next American attack was made from Fort Niagara, a military post in New York on the shore of Lake Ontario. A small group of American soldiers crossed the Niagara River and attacked the British. But some Americans from New York refused to cross the border to help against the British. They calmly watched as British soldiers shot down the attacking Americans. The third campaign was made by General Henry Dearborn. He led a state militia force from Plattsburgh, New York, to the Canadian border. He was planning to cross the border and attack Montreal. But again, the soldiers refused to cross the border. Dearborn could do nothing but march them back to Plattsburgh. British forces at this time were winning victories. They captured an American fort in northern Michigan, and Indians fighting for the British captured a fort at the place now known as Chicago. Instead of marching through Canada without difficulty, the Americans found themselves trying hard to keep the British out of the state of Ohio. For a while, the small American Navy was doing better than the Army. Just 2 months after the war started, the United States warship Constitution forced a British ship to surrender. Several months later, another American ship, the Wasp, captured the British ship Frolic. Then a frigate named the United States defeated one of Britain's most famous fighting ships, the Macedonian. The British ship was captured and brought to the United States. There were other victories at sea. At the end of 6 months, the United States Navy had captured 6 British ships and lost only 1 of its own vessels. Private American trade ships had been armed with guns when the war started. They, too, were successful against the British. They captured more than 300 British trade ships. But the American successes forced Britain to bring more of its fighting ships into the war with the United States. By the middle of 1813, a year after the war started, British ships controlled the East Coast. No American ship could enter or leave any port south of New England. Meanwhile, the military situation was improving for the Americans in what was then the West. William Henry Harrison, governor of the Indiana Territory, formed a large force to try to capture Detroit from the British. At the same time, Captain Oliver Perry built 5 warships on Lake Erie. With these, and 4 he already had, Perry met and defeated a British naval force. Perry reported his victory to Harrison. "We have met the enemy, and they are ours." Perry's victory and Harrison's large force caused the British to withdraw from Detroit and from a British fort at Malton in Canada. Harrison's men continued to chase the enemy. They caught them and defeated them in the Battle of the Tens. Killed in this battle was the great Indian chief Tecumseh, who had been fighting for the British. American forces made new attempts to win control of Lake Ontario and invade Canada across the Niagara River. But none of these succeeded. Late in 1813, British soldiers crossed the river and captured Fort Niagara. They also burned the town of Buffalo. By April 1814, Napoleon was forced from power in Europe, and the war between France and Britain was over. The end of the war in Europe permitted Britain to send many of its soldiers to fight against the United States. About 4,000 British soldiers landed on the Chesapeake coast, southeast of Washington. They met American forces inland at Bladensburg, a town 10 kilometers from Washington. The British soldiers broke through the American lines, and the Americans began to run away. But a group of sailors refused to retreat with their artillery. Commanded by Joshua Barney, the 400 sailors chose to stand and fight. The struggle did not last long against the 4,000 British soldiers. Barney held his position for a half hour before enemy soldiers got behind his men and silenced their guns. Barney was wounded seriously. The British thought so much of his courage that they carried him to a hospital for their own soldiers at Bladensburg. Barney himself said the British officers treated him as a brother. Once the British troops had smashed through Barney's Navy men, nothing stood between them and Washington. The commanders of the British force, General Robert Ross and Admiral George Cockburn, took a group of men to the Capitol building and set fire to it. Then the two commanders went to the White House with the same intention. Before setting fire to the president's home, Cockburn took one of Madison's hats and the seat from one of Dolly Madison's chairs. The admiral found the president's table set for dinner. As a joke, he took a glass of wine and toasted the health of President Jemmy. President Madison had fled the White House. He crossed the Potomac River and started toward his home in Virginia. He joined his wife on the road the second day. They decided to wait about 25 kilometers from Washington. When President Madison returned to the Capitol 3 days later, the British had withdrawn. They had also burned most public buildings. The British coastal force next attacked the city of Baltimore. The story of that battle and the song it inspired will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.